Well, hello, and welcome to the Robert A. Heinlein Book Club. And in this episode, we'll begin our look at Tunnel in the Sky, which was published first in 1955, and is his, I believe it's his ninth juvenile. So we're really coming to the end here. Only got three more after this, but there's going to be a few other novels interspersed from this point forward. We got like a Double Star and Door into Summer, I think, along with the other juveniles. So I don't know. This one, I feel I have a little bit less to say about. I thought it'd be a little more interesting when I read the concept behind it, in part because like this very idea was played with by Philip Dick. And I obviously read Philip Dick before I read in this Heinlein stuff, even though Philip Dick is responding to Heinlein in many ways. But you had like two novels in particular that thematically are very close to this. One is called Lies Inc., in which people use basically a portal to travel to resettle people to other planets. But that's a one-way trip. So the only way of knowing really what's going on is by sending a real ship that can return with information. So that is a wild story with a lot of weird psychedelic stuff. And then you have The Crack in Space, in which people are basically sent, because of overpopulation, are sent to other planets through again, sort of portals. But they don't have that yet. So people are being cryo until they figure that out. And it turns out they're just sending people to Earth at another time. And actually, for a moment in this book, I thought that's where they're going to go with it. I thought, you know, because they give you, or Heinlein gives you, a red herring of time travel earlier in the novel. So I thought we were going to get kind of a time travel thing where these kids were going to Earth at a previous point in its history. Now, of course, if you read Many Colored Land, that's that concept, right, is the Julian Mays series where people go to like the Paleozoic or the Pliocene. They go back to an earlier time, and there's other humanoids there. And of course, it's like you got the megafauna, and there's all sorts of adventure wrapped up in that. So I kind of thought for a while we were going to get a bit of that. And halfway through the novel, it seems it's just another planet. So Heinlein ended up kind of taking the most, a slightly more boring approach. Now, of course, this was published not long after Lord of the Flies, so it has that kind of feel too, where it's a bunch of teenagers dropped into another planet and forced to kind of live, to survive, to endure. Now, let's roll back and deal with kind of the elephant in the room, and that is once again Malthusianism. Now, I don't think Heinlein is obsessed with Malthusian logic. Obviously, we had it in novels like Farmer in the Sky, this idea that overpopulation is going to lead to a crisis of calories on Earth. Now, I wouldn't have said too much about it and just kind of say this is just the trope of the time. This is in a lot of science fiction in the 50s and 60s. Even Philip Dick got a little bit of it. But, of course, it was common in those eras. It was the age of Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, where people did believe in this Malthusian logic, you know, with the post-World War II rising birth rates. We were in that stage two of the demographic transition, at least much of the world was. And it was leading to pretty astounding growth rates. But looking at it from our point of view, you know, where growth rates are rapidly declining, a lot of countries are in population free fall, in decline, and areas that were once concerns back in the 60s are actually, and actually here, it's always, Heinlein likes to pick on the Chinese. He does it here like he did in Farmer in the Sky. But actually, that's a country that's experiencing rapid population decline, as is all of East Asia is experiencing that. So, the Malthusian logic just isn't pan out. It doesn't have that same impact on us today that it maybe did back in the time that this was written. And I want to forgive him, but he does call out Malthus directly and basically internalize Malthus's logic, saying exactly, agricultural production increases arithmetically, population increases geometrically. That just is not proven by any of the data. Even in the population bomb days, you had the Green Revolution. You had food supplies kept up with population. Remember, and here's, I'm a broken record on this point, but people are producers, they're not just consumers. Malthus's biggest error was seeing people just as little mouths to feed, not as people who actually create more. The Marxist logic is, of course, that people are exploited. They produce more than they consume. That's what exploitation means. A worker produces, 10 pairs of shoes, but only can afford to buy one pair of shoe for that work. And those extra 9 shoes are overproduction. Everyone who's exploited is an overproducer, producing more than they need. And that's how capitalism works, right? If people could only produce what they consume, then there'd be no profit. In fact, people are always overproducing. Now, yes, is there food shortages? Is there environmental pressures? Is there all those kinds of things? Yes, but it has, that's usually local. It's man-made. It's not global. It's not a systemic problem. Exploitation is a much bigger problem than underproduction, right? And the problem in capitalism is overproduction. It always has been. It's not like pre-modern times where people starve because there was not enough food. People starve because there's too much food, right? It's like during the Great Depression, people dumping out, the milk that they couldn't sell. All that to say, I get annoyed when Heinlein falls for this trope, especially someone who has these libertarian views about things, and he's so judgmental about births. And he is here pretty judgmental about births. And I don't think this novel needs it. So what's going on in here? So you have overpopulation on Earth, and space travel is too difficult. Now, Heinlein, in this point in his career, seems to be dancing between portals and those ships that we see in like Skylift, those ones that continue to accelerate at 3-4 Gs indefinitely until they reach near speed of light travel. Torch ships, I think he calls them, right? So he's dancing between those ideas. Now, in this, so we have books where FTL is possible, and we have books like this where FTL is not possible. Instead, we have portals. Now, this comes out of technology that was originally developed for time travel, and the time travel failed, but teleportation worked. And so people are able to warp to other planets. So what happens is populations will then go to these other planets, and they're usually the frontier conditions as they develop an economy there. And so that means only people that can go there initially are people who are well-trained in survival. And sometime in the future, maybe 100 years later, they will develop enough of an economy to allow trade through these portals back. But for that first period of time, it's going to be frontier conditions. So this is a very American way of looking at the question of population growth and expansion. It's like you always have to have the frontier experience, right? So that's, Heinlein does, certainly he thinks of space as a frontier experience. He's talked about this endlessly in the Green Hills of Earth stories, and it's there in a lot of the juveniles, like in Farmer in the Sky. Here he's probably more explicit about the fact that you're going to have frontier conditions, and he does this by creating this period in which that's just going to be a primitive colony that no one's going to want to trade with. It's going to have to develop its own economy. But you're seeding populations all over the universe, essentially. So that's, long term, this could be a really interesting universe. Short term, it's kind of a one-way trip. All right. So that's what we got. Where does our character fit into this? Well, our main character is Rod Walker. Which somewhere I read that he was conceived of by Heinlein as a black character. He doesn't have a racial identity expressed in the text. So take it or leave it. I think it's based on a letter. He's a student at a high school, and he is in a training mission organized by the school, where they sent kids for a short period of time through these portals to test their survivability, to test if they can survive. It's like a Boy Scout trip, but more risky, where you could die, where people are risking their lives. So it's students want to do it as a means of competing, of showing off, of getting the clout, the name recognition, and all that. But not everyone does it. And some people try and they fail, and some people are failed just for not having enough preparation. There are students who fail this even before they leave because they didn't bring the right gear or whatever. But the students are told what kind of planet they're going to go to. They have to prepare their gear, and then they go. And they live out like a week or something, survive, and then they're recalled back. And based on this, this is like training for a future date where they may be actually going to one of these other planets as a permanent settler. Okay, so that is the story. And basically what happens is he's part of a group of students going to this planet. They go, and he survives, and there's no recall. They're like abandoned. We don't know why. He's got a theory. Rod Walker's theory initially is that they're on Earth because it's cloudy. He can't see the stars. So he thinks maybe they're just on Earth. They've just been transported to like the Southern Hemisphere to trick people. And it's a way of doing this on the cheap. And they're just supposed to go out and find Johannesburg and declare themselves victors and all that. And that's played with, but it's pretty much dumped pretty quickly. So Rod runs into another child, a young girl named Jacqueline, but she's cross-dressing. She's acting as a boy, or she just doesn't come out and say she's a girl. She just is doing her thing as a young student. And I think this is really interesting. It was probably the most interesting part of the book. And maybe I'm crowded by the fact that, you know, I've read those Philip Dick novels. I've read Many Colored Land, and I'm feeling like, I'm not getting too much new out of this. I've read Lord of the Flies. I'm not that excited about anything I'm seeing. But what is exciting for me is Jacqueline, this character of Jacqueline, in part because, you know, it's not like she's trans. It's not like Jack is a trans man. Like, Jack is a girl. And identifies as a girl, but doesn't present as a girl early on in the story when we first meet her. So it's kind of like Willis and Lummix, who not really are trans. I mean, they just are just interpreted a certain way by others, right? So gender is partially representation. It's partially identity. It's partially how other people interact with you, right, and treat you. And in Lummix, Willis, and Jack's perspective, it's all... they are gendered male. The assumption is they're male by the others around them, our main characters, right? But the reality is revealed to be different. And it's just Heinlein's making a point about gender representation is, you know, up to the individual. And Jack basically presents physically more male, acts more male, or at least doesn't make a point of reminding Rod that she's a girl. She just is doing this, maybe to protect herself, maybe, but I think especially because she doesn't feel she needs to. It's just who she is. And I think there's a lot of, I think the fact that this keeps coming up in Heinlein stories, I think is significant. I think this is not just a throwaway fun reference he likes to do. I think it's a cornerstone of his gender politics. It's not just strong, assertive women. It's that, in a sense, you know, we should not have these assumptions about what people are and capable of based on their gender. He's against, I think, externalized gender like conformity. I think. And I'm becoming more and more convinced that if he was alive today, he certainly would be a supporter of trans rights and maybe would be trans himself. He certainly liked to play with this a lot. He thinks about it a lot. So I wonder if he himself, would have in a different era had a more flexible gender identity. So, anyways, I'm really thinking here about the first 8 chapters of this book because it's about halfway through. It's a little bit more than half of the text of the book. But there's not that much to say. I think there's going to be some interesting stuff in the second half because when at about the halfway point of the novel, they start to form a society because it's pretty clear by this point that they're not being recalled, that they're sort of on their own. And so now why is that? Is this on purpose? I don't even know. Like, is this a bigger test? Is it that they just would... I'm also thinking, are they just being abandoned because of the overpopulation crisis and that the intention of the school is just to let them try to make it, just like any other settler, and that this is just, they've just been tricked, bait and switched about the goals? That I find a hard time believing because these are like high school students with families that are expecting their kids back. So maybe it's a technological thing or whatever, some issue with it. But... but the first half is really mostly just Rod, Jack, and a few other boys that they find on the way, beginning to come to terms with the fact that they're sort of abandoned, that they're on their own, and need to find a long-term survival, learn to survive long-term, right? And I think that's essentially the story we're going to get, but it's going to be about building society. That much is pretty clear, that they're going to form institutions and laws and governing systems and economies of a certain sort that's going to allow them to survive. And that's the test. And that's part of growing up, right? I think that's a theme in enough of the juveniles. I don't think it's a leap to suggest that this is where Heinlein thinks this is an important theme. It's just dealt with a little bit more directly here. Now, compared to the other juveniles, I'm not as like content with this one. And I wonder if this is because the plot itself, or maybe I'm distracted by the Malthusian stuff. It bothers me. It annoys me. And whatever. But it kind of is made up for the fact that I think Jack is such a fascinating character. But once again, we have a juvenile in which our main character, is more forgettable than the cast of characters around them. Like in Star Beast, Lummix and Kiku are way more interesting than John Thomas Stewart. Although he's a little more interesting than some of the other juvenile heroes. But, Hazel Stone, much more interesting than whoever those boys, Castor and Pollux. I'm actually starting to remember the name of some of these boys. So that's probably a good sign that he's getting better at writing these. But I still think it's the characters around them are more interesting. And some of them are young characters. So he can write young, compelling, interesting characters. It's just that main character is always kind of the same. And he's not escaped that fully yet. John Thomas Stewart was a move in the right direction. But here, this is almost like a move back. He's kind of boring and uninteresting. There's not much that's special about him. Jack, though, wonderful character. So anyways, is that it for now? I guess that's all I'm going to say about the first half of Tunnel in the Sky. Not bad. I mean, I think it's a lot of fun. And I'm excited to see where it goes once they're sort of settled. What are the tensions and dilemmas? There's going to have to be something. Now, hopefully it's not just they get lost and have to be saved or through their brilliance save themselves. I'll rip out my hair if that's the case. Hopefully we're never going to see that again in these stories. But are they going to get back or is it a one-way trip? I think that either way would be interesting. So I'm excited to see where this story goes. Is Jack and Rod going to develop some sort of relationship? That could be interesting. Are we going to see more playing with Jack's gender identity? That's the other thing I'm kind of going to be looking for. So I guess that's going to be it for now. So in the next episode, I'll talk about the end of this book, and then we'll move on. I think there might be a short story or two for 1955, but if not, we'll just move on to A Time for Stars, which is the number 10th, the 10th of these juveniles. All right, that's it for now. So pretty good. Not as good as Star Beast, in my view, but a strong entry into this series of novels. So that's it for now. I'll see you next time when I finish up my thoughts on Tunnel in the Sky. Thanks for listening.